This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll visit with the legendary Daniel Ellsberg, the longtime political activist who will talk about the legacy of the Pentagon Papers and his latest work, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Also on the show, Mark Ballard, Capitol Bureau Chief for The Advocate on the first week of the special session and what's going on in state government. We'll hear from prominent singer Corey Brannan, who's performing tonight in Baton Rouge, and he has been named by Rolling Stone as one of the artists to watch, and he is in our community this evening. And Amy Chua, Yale Law professor, her book is Political Tribes: America is Beginning to Display Destructive Political Dynamics, Much More Typical of Developing Non-Western Countries, says Dr. Chua. Now the news on 89.3 WRKM. This is Jim Inkster, and we start today's show with the legendary Daniel Ellsberg, the man who gave us the Pentagon Papers, who is now portrayed on the big screen in The Post. And Daniel Ellsberg is back with a Doomsday Machine book. That's the title, The Doomsday Machine. He says it's loomed over humanity for decades, and we have an imminent threat of nuclear war. Good morning, Daniel Ellsberg.
Good morning. That's such an ominous introduction, but it's accurate. Thank you.
Why is it more imminent now than before?
For the first time at this moment, we have a president making threats of first use of nuclear weapons or threats of non-nuclear that would likely escalate against the nuclear weapons state. That hasn't happened since the Cuban Missile Crisis 55 years ago, in which I participated. In other words, we really do have, as soon as the Olympics are over, we may resume threats on both sides. In effect, both of these leaders, Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump, are using their nuclear weapons by threatening them the way that you use a gun when you point it at someone in a confrontation, whether you pull the trigger or not. Now, as I show in my book, many presidents, in fact, one could argue all of them have considered at least doing that, and many of them have actually done that in crises, often in secret from the public. Rarely as blatantly as we're seeing right now, and as I say, this is the first time in half a century or more that it's involved an opponent that had nuclear weapons themselves. So the chance of a two-sided nuclear war, even though it would be relatively limited compared to, let's say, the Cuban Missile Crisis or a crisis over Berlin with Russia, which could occur over Ukraine or Syria or Georgia or the Baltics, has the possibility, even this smaller nuclear war, would still kill more people in a day or a week than the human species has ever seen. So I would say that it's too bad and should be changed that the public is really not that concerned about the risks that are being taken in our name right now in terms of war with North Korea.
Daniel Ellsberg worked at the highest levels of nuclear planning at the RAND Corporation in the early 1960s. And what is more possible, an accidental nuclear event or an intentional one?
Well, they're both possible. Neither are highly likely, but the very possibility is real. In both cases, it's well more than zero. I would say the most dangerous possibility, likelihood, and we've come close to this in the past, is a false alarm of an imminent attack on one side or the other, which we've had a number of times in this country facing Russia or the USSR, and likewise in Russia, and especially if that takes place during a crisis or what's felt to be a crisis. Cuban Missile Crisis was an example, but not the last one. In 1983, the Russians feared, Andropov, leader of the Russians, feared President Reagan with his rhetoric and his huge expenditure, unprecedented expenditure then until now, of nuclear weapons, on nuclear weapons modernization, quote, was about to launch a first strike on him or escalate, and he was prepared to preempt that if necessary, which would have been not just suicidal, but omnicidal. Virtually everyone would have died. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, his plans for preemption were pretty much like ours. And in the midst of that fear, actually, a major false alarm occurred in Russia with a mistaken indication from their satellites American missiles were on their way. And only one man decided that the risk wasn't certain enough that he said that it was a false alarm, not knowing whether it was or not. Thanks to that prudence, we're here today. We wouldn't be otherwise. So the world has been hanging on this risk of a mistake or a false alarm on the other side of the world killing all of us for more than half a century. And in a way, the a premonition of that was the Hawaiian false alarm just about a month ago, in which a million Hawaiians were led to feel that their whole world was about to evaporate, incinerate within minutes And that was a false alarm, but it was a consciousness of a risk that we've been living with unconscionably for over half a century. That we should change that. We should dismantle the doomsday machine. We should demand that other countries, starting with Russia, dismantle theirs. And that doesn't mean in the first instance or in the foreseeable future going down to zero nuclear weapons. It does mean dismantling, rejecting, defunding, taking apart the ability to end life on Earth with the thousands of warheads both we and Russia have accrued.
When you were 30 years old, you were given the responsibility of writing a plan for how the United States would employ a nuclear attack that would have killed tens of millions of people then. How was that experience for you?
Well, let me correct just one thing there. The plan I was supposed to modify was the Eisenhower plan that envisioned not killing tens of millions, but hundreds of millions, specifically 600 million, as I say on the second page of my book. Very few people have ever seen those estimates, and the government has never actually released an estimate. That estimate is probably still classified. I tried to bring in withholding options against from cities, from Central Command, from China, which was planned to be hit in any event of armed conflict with Russia. We were going to annihilate the Chinese. So I thought I'd get it down, if worst came to worst, from hundreds of millions, or in reality, it turned out later, it would have been billions, down from the hundreds of millions that were estimated to tens of millions. First of all, the changes that I proposed and that President Kennedy authorized, but Secretary of Defense McNamara actually sent to the chiefs as changes in their plans, they didn't really eventuate anyway. The war would not have been affected by my involvement. But even if it had, if my plans had been followed, that was insane. To bring it down from hundreds of millions to scores of millions, well, one could say some kind of improvement, but we're still talking about an insane plan. And I look back on that. At the time, I thought it was the best I could do. I was even proud of it. I'm not so proud of it now.
Are you surprised that there has not been a nuclear war in the...
Yes, very surprised. And that's because I'm aware of the many false alarms and the secret threats in crises public simply doesn't know about. I was saying to my wife, Patricia, just the other day, if I knew only what the public knows, I wouldn't be worried about this either, about all-out war or even as much about Korea. But I am burdened with that knowledge, and that's why I've for 40 years been trying to put it out. Finally found a publisher, Bloomsbury, that was willing to put out what I call, by the way, you didn't mention my subtitle, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. And the reason for that, as I just explained, Doomsday Machines, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. There's a lot of people who, if they really reflect on their past involvement, might well be moved to make some confessions, and I hope they do, a kind of nuclear Me Too moment.
You're portrayed now on the big screen. The Post has been an overwhelming success. Your thoughts about the movie and the legacy of the Pentagon Papers?
Well, the movie, by the way, doesn't mention something that was much in my mind at that time, and that was the possibility that the war would actually escalate to a nuclear war. And later documents that have come out on the Nixon administration shows that he was making the threats that I believed he was making and was making plans for possible nuclear expansion of the war at that time. But that doesn't come into the movie. But what does come in is the possible effects of having the courage on the newspaper's part to face very significant commercial risks, even risks of their own prosecution, to put out the truth. Without their actions, of course, nothing would have happened. And in fact, they do make it right at the end of the film, just in passing, headlines showing that not only the Times and the Post took these risks of defying the president, but 17 other newspapers, 19 in all, a kind of wave of civil disobedience, in effect, because the president and attorney general and the Defense Department were telling them that what they were doing was endangering the country. That was during an ongoing war. And they looked at the papers and the history involved, and they said, no, we don't agree with that. And they acted in the light of the First Amendment to inform the public. So the film reminds us of the possibility of doing that, and the courage that it takes, the fears that these people had and overcame, and the possible effect of it, which did, in fact, help shorten the war.
Are you amazed, Daniel Ellsberg, that you went toe-to-toe with President Nixon, a man bent on destroying you? After all, he even had plumbers break into your psychoanalyst's office. You went toe-to-toe with him. He lost his job, and you avoided any jail time for
Well,
what
I
you've done.
Avoided the my charges were dismissed in the context of the presidential crimes that faced him with impeachment and even conviction and forced him to resign. So the fact that all that came to light, not by me, by the way, but by others like John Dean or Alex Butterfield, who revealed the taping system in the White House, or people who refused to fire the special prosecutor, an issue that's very much with us at this moment. But with the attorney general refusing to fire the special prosecutor and the next in line also refusing and resigning, so-called Saturday Night Massacre, the public awoke to the fact that the Constitution was very much endangered, and in term, as it is right now, I would say, conceivably, and may have similar results. But anyway, all of that was unpredictable. It was extremely unlikely. The more you knew, the less likely it would have seemed. So it was kind of miraculous that the president was forced to resign, and that made the war endable. All these people prior, including me and many others who took chances up to that, not only they could, I think hardly any of us could have foreseen that it would have the effect it did. But it did, and it shows that these acts of courage by all these different people in resigning and in publishing the truth and telling the truth, they all contributed to saving lives, American and Vietnamese, in Vietnam, ultimately. So it was worthwhile. The risks are worthwhile, or can be worthwhile, although there's no guarantee.
And we'll return with more Daniel Ellsberg commentary after this pause for Talk Louisiana on 89.3 WRKN. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana on 89.3 WRKM. Coming in just a few minutes, we'll hear from Mark Ballard, Capitol Bureau Chief for The Advocate. But we continue our discussion with Daniel Ellsberg, the legendary person who leaked the Pentagon Papers and continues to follow American life and politics. His latest work is regarding the prospect of a nuclear war, which he says could be imminent. It's called The Doomsday Machine. The book is The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner from Daniel Ellsberg, a legendary figure once called the most dangerous man in America. Lastly, Professor Ellsberg, your thoughts about the current president of the United States.
Well, I've just said that I think that we, not for the first time, we really see endangerment to the Constitution and to our liberties. In fact, this recent book about the president, Fire and Fury, by Michael Wolfe, the administration actually threatened the publisher with legal action if they didn't withdraw it, which they didn't do. But we really haven't seen anything like that since the Pentagon Papers case, in a way. There have been some censoring of books, a few since then, but this was a very blatant case. And the, I would say, clear obstruction of justice seems to be going on. I say as a layman, just reading the papers, my greatest concern is the North Korean threats at this point. We shouldn't be threatening war with North Korea. We should be negotiating, which they're refusing to do without a totally unattainable goal, which is the total denuclearization of North Korea. They think that they would be giving up their deterrent against attack, and they're just following in the footsteps of eight other nuclear states, starting with us, when they do that. And they're not going to do that. But the Chinese and the Russian, their closest allies, believe that they could be stopped in negotiation from going on to ICBMs and H-bombs, and that would be very worthwhile. The idea of not negotiating is just fruitful, I think, of a disastrous war. So I am very worried about the current administration. But these problems did not start with Trump, and they won't end with Trump. Our nuclear policy for well over half a century, perhaps for 70 years, has been extremely unwise, and it's resulted in a situation where the life of humanity as a whole is at risk in a way that is unconscionable.
Do you think President Nixon would have survived if not for the Pentagon Papers? Was that the catalyst to all that happened after that?
It was the catalyst a view of his chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, and others, that it started with that. It wasn't the Pentagon Papers alone, though. He was worried that I had documents on him I should say, his administration and his planning, including his nuclear threats against North Vietnam. I knew of those threats verbally, orally passed on to me, but I didn't have documents. I could have, though, if people who had access to those documents had done what they might have done, and that is put them out publicly or given them to me. He was worried about that, and the reason he took criminal acts against me were to keep me from releasing such documents if I had them. But as one of the people who did have them, Roger Morris, an aide to Henry Kissinger, said later, he was ashamed and regretted that he had not released those documents, including photographs of nuclear targets in North Vietnam. And he said, we should have thrown open the safes and screamed bloody murder, because that's exactly what it was.
The book again, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner, a man who's been on the scene for well over half a century, Daniel Ellsberg. It's been a pleasure to talk with you, Professor Ellsberg.
Thank you. Thank you.
And as we switch gears, we're going to be joined by Mark Ballard, Capitol Bureau Chief for The Advocate. I do want to note that at Southeastern Louisiana University, the campus had some drama last night. An incident occurred on North Campus involving several individuals. Reports of gunshots fired. Some individuals suffered non-life-threatening injuries, and the campus is open for business today. Mark Ballard is with us, and down at the Capitol, it's been lively. Not that lively, but nonetheless, the governor opened the special session on Monday night, and right now, they're about 12 days away from shutting it down and moving on to the regular session with the hope that the so-called fiscal cliff can be averted. Mark, how's it looking?
Well, actually, you know, as of last night, it started looking pretty good. If by good you want to define it as getting some sort of deal taken care of. The House is going to be coming back in on Sunday, and from everything we hear is that the Ways and Means Committee is going to move a couple of tax bills. The Health and Welfare Committee, which couldn't move any of those Medicaid reform bills yesterday, we'll be moving those bills on Sunday afternoon, and then there'll be a vote by the full House on the only two real measures that have actually kind of gotten out of committee so far, and that's the spending cap that the Speaker would like to impose, and the bill that would allow the Ohio check, a more easy website to look at the state government finances.
The governor on his monthly radio show indicated he would accept at least part of a renewal of the penny tax, maybe half a cent, quarter cent, but he says compromise is a necessity, and that means he'll have to give and the Republican majority will have to give to get things done. Is it possible we're going to have some sort of a consensus on continuing the at least part of the penny sales tax?
That seems to be where we're going with it. It's called the Dwight Bill, and what it would do is it would make permanent a quarter cent of that fifth penny that's falling off in June or on June 30th. And it would also kind of strip away some of the exemptions that are on some of the other sales taxes. The items that don't have sales taxes charged on them, they'll start charging sales tax on them. On the other side, they're also working on some sort of income tax. They're trying to put the language in some sort of income tax changes. The possibility of this excess itemized federal income taxes that could be passing through. There is a little bit of talk about going on with changing the tax brackets by kind of narrowing them. That would increase income taxes, but everybody seems to think that it's the excess itemized deductions, which Louisiana gets and most states do not, that mm-hmm. is going to be the one that moves.
877-217-5757 or 297-5633. You can always email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. And a listener asks about the governor's address Monday night. Were there any surprises?
Well, I mean, it depends on what you consider as a surprise. I mean, I was surprised that he didn't have a more focused message about, you know, what we need to do and why we need to do it. It seemed to be kind of going all over the place. But it was pretty much the same speech that we had heard dozens and dozens of times over the last couple of months.
Well, the lawmakers were applauding nicely at certain points, and we're talking about a legislature, Mark, that has just 42 Democrats in the House and 15 in the Senate. The governor obviously is playing with a very bad hand when it comes to trying to get two-thirds support on a tax measure. He has to have support from the other side to make it happen.
He does. I mean, he's going to need to have 70 votes, and he may be able to get that. I mean, there is a faction of the Republican Party that wouldn't give him anything regardless of what he asked for, but there appears to be enough folks in the legislature, at least among the House Republicans, that are saying we need to do something, and I guess what remains to be seen, and we'll find out pretty quickly on Sunday night, is if that number with the Democrats adds up to 70. I tend to think that it might. You know, when I was a young reporter, I interviewed Jim Finks of the New Orleans Saints general manager the first time that they were good, and he said that, you know, deals are not made until everybody is ready, and I think that we've, for the last 2 years, we've been waiting for everybody to be ready, and I think they're about ready now.
877-217-5757 is your number, and we'll talk some more with Mark Ballard, the Capital Bureau Chief for The Advocate. Yesterday was an interesting day for the number three person in state government, Tom Shedler. We'll talk about that. And also, a listener asks whether there will be any movement toward more gun regulation in the Louisiana legislature when the regular session begins. We're back with more from Mark Ballard after this pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757 is your number for Talk Louisiana. If you're in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. We're continuing with Mark Ballard, the Capital Bureau Chief for The Advocate. The special session is continuing as it moves along until March 7th, if necessary. And then March 12th, lawmakers will convene for the regular legislative session. And this one is one in which all kinds of topics will be offered for public discussion. Mark, is there going to be any movement toward any kind of gun regulation based on the tragedy in Florida last week?
Well, I think Jim Shannon on your station just reported that Raymond Garofalo is filing a bill to allow teachers to farm in the classroom. I'm suspecting that we'll see quite a few of those on both sides, you know, to try to register guns or be tighter on the registration, as well as to have more people carrying the guns as well. This is this particular session is one where it's not going to be finance focused, so that it's the type of issue that will get lots of attention.
Well, Chalmette Representative Raymond Garofalo is introducing a bill that would allow school educators to carry weapons on campus if they have proper training. He says the deterrence level of a criminal or a crazy person knowing that there is a possibility that they're going to run into armed resistance at a school is a lot more than we have now. So we'll see what happens, but the President of the United States is advocating that teachers be armed. It's an interesting world in which we live right now.
Yeah, and Garofalo is a close follower of Trump. He's very conservative, and so it comes as no surprise, and that's why I think we'll be seeing a lot of these. And there'll be a big argument, because I'm pretty sure that there are a lot of people, a lot of parents in the world that don't want their kids going to a school where the teachers are packing.
All right, Mark, you're fading a bit on us, but I did want to ask you before you leave about the controversy swirling about the Secretary of State, Tom Shedler. The headline in The Advocate today, Shedler says he had consensual sex with accuser, harassment lawsuit filed against Secretary of State. This is the kind of thing that in today's environment could have some momentum. What do you think?
Well, it's, I can't imagine how he's going to survive this. I imagine he'll be resigning fairly soon. If his entire defense and what he's saying is that this was a consensual affair, that's still dealing with, he had a consensual affair with someone who worked directly for him, and that raises a lot of issues in and of itself. So forget about whether the accusations that are being made are accurate or not, and I don't know. His defense of it is something that's going to end up having to, he's probably going to end up having to resign.
Mark Ballard, it is always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jim.
See you next week. Take care.
See you next week.
And we're joined now by Corey Brannon. He's a popular singer who's from the Memphis area. He'll be performing tonight at the Hartley Bay Theater here in Baton Rouge. And it is a pleasure to talk with you, Corey.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks.
And I think right now you're on your way to Baton Rouge, and you have had an interesting career. And as I noted at the beginning of our program today, you were named, I think, by Rolling Stone as one of the 10 artists we need to know. So you have a following. How would you describe your genre?
Yeah, I certainly leave that up to other people. I consider it a bit of a toe tag, but yeah, it's songwriter stuff. It's telling stories, but musically, I'm not too beholden to. It's a grab bag of rock and punk and blues and country, and it's a big mess.
Well, as I mentioned, you're from the Memphis area. You know the southern part of our country rather well. And tonight at the Hartley Bay Theater, we'll hear more from Corey Brannon and Matt Doyle. Let's give a listen to some of this gentleman's fine work.
It was undeniably summer and I was certifiably cool. With my acid-washed jacket and my stone-washed jeans, I rose out of the kiddie pool. You were a walking one ad, you had summer on your side. Our front yards faced each other's from across the great divide. And the sunbeams cracked like jumper cables. I was cranking up the Mellon Camp, and you were dancing barefoot on a picnic table. And damn it, girl, truly, goddamn it, girl, truly, goddamn it, girl, truly, goddamn. Woo! I still remember every word you said, like I always said I would. Since you walked on the waterbed, stood right there in my head for good.
Corey Brannon, tonight you'll be at the Hartley Bay Theater. Corey, I mentioned you were on the David Letterman show in 2003. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, it was pretty great. I had just put out the first record there in Memphis, and it got to him, the track, and he put it on his load-in music, and he's like, let the kid come on. It was the first truly independent artist to be on the show in about 7 years. A lot of the what they call independent artists were, subsidiaries of a major label, but we were, a one-man label. And Dave was just kind enough to have me on, which was a dream for me. I used to stay up late, and I wanted to be David Letterman when I was a kid, so it was a personal bit of a coup for me.
You said you wanted to be David Letterman?
I didn't even understand what it was when I was a kid. There's nothing like that on TV, so I stayed up late and watched it. Yeah, it was an honor.
You've been doing this for about two decades. What are some of the favorite venues you've performed in along the way?
I've got to do some on the, the classic ones, the Fillmore in San Francisco, the Ryman in Nashville. But I tend to find that my favorite place to play is a really run-down old place, but that has a good sound system and kind people. So one of my favorites is actually called the Whitewater Tavern in Little Rock, Arkansas. And I tell you, if you took the stickers off the wall, I don't think the place would stand. but it's the place, I think when Clinton was still governor there in Arkansas, if they had a good week, I think he would take all his staff and they would just get deep in the cups. So it's been around for a while. I love that place.
The Whitewater Tavern. Well, you'll be in a nice place tonight at the Hartley Bay Theater. And
I'm excited about it. Down by the water. I've played there before. I'm looking forward to that.
And you certainly have a southern theme. People, I think, know from what part of the country you're from.
Yeah, you can't wash it off. You can hear it.
Well, when Rolling Stone named you a few years ago as one of the 10 artists we need to know, that had to be quite a thrill.
Yeah, but the magazine's always been kind. Each record, they've been real supportive, so it helps. You know, it mm-hmm. is press. It's calling as soon as the magazine's off the stand, but, you know, it's nice. Whatever gets some more ears on it, I'm all about it, you know. I don't do it for myself.
A listener, Tracy, asks where you do your recording.
The last record was actually done in Mississippi. I had a friend that had a world-class studio out in the woods there. But I've recorded at Ardent in Memphis and a studio in a couple in Nashville, Colorado. I did my third record in San Francisco. Wherever seems mm-hmm. to fit the time and the group of musicians that I can gather together.
Where did you do No Hit Wonder?
That was in Nashville. That was with producer Paul Ebersole. He did a lot of Memphis stuff. He started out and did a lot of Memphis soul stuff, and then he made just crazy money in the 90s and 2000s doing big rock acts. But then he moved to Nashville, and he's like, you know, I'm just going to do what I want. And I was lucky enough to work with Paul on that one.
And I understand you and your wife, Corey, were married in an unusual place. So where did you tie the knot?
Oh, yeah, down at the Shack Up Inn in Clarksdale, Mississippi. It's actually family runs that, family now.
The Shack Up Inn.
Yes, sir. It's an old cotton gin that they turned into a juke joint, and there were old shacks on the property, sharecropper shacks from way back, and they took the shacks and they turned them into hotel rooms, and then they started bringing shacks on flatbeds from all around Mississippi. They would find them and they would fix them up just enough for them to be hotel rooms, and so it's out by the crossroads down there, not the, you know, fictional crossroads, but the, you know, the Southern Cross and the Dog, the railroad, and then 61 and 49 cross, and it's right up there by the crossroads.
We'll be back with more Talk Louisiana, and we thank you for joining us today. Have a good show tonight, Corey Brannan, at the Hartley Vay Theater. It's been a pleasure. Take care. We're joined, if things go according to plan, by Yale Law Professor Amy Chua after this brief pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We're joined by Amy Chua. She is a professor at the Yale Law School, a noted expert in the fields of ethnic conflict and globalization, and her latest work is Political Tribes, Group Instinct, and the Fate of Nations. Good morning to you, Professor Chua.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk with you. And you note in your book that, in your judgment, America is beginning to display some political dynamics that are more typical of developing non-Western countries. What's going on with the widely changing world in which we live, not only globally, but right here in the United States?
Well, you know, it's funny because I've been studying democracy and conflict and tribalism in countries outside the United States for 20 years. I've, you know, looked at Latin America and Southeast Asia, and what is startling is that a lot of these dynamics that I've looked at that have really almost destroyed nations are starting to appear in this country. So it's a really dangerous moment, and part of it has to do with our massive demographic change. I mean, this is just a fact that I think for most of this country's history, America was dominated by an economically, politically, culturally dominant white majority. So things felt very stable. You know, it kind of seems like, oh, there's no tribalism here, because all of the other smaller sub-tribes and groups were suppressed and quiet. They were silenced. So now we're at this moment where, with recent immigration, as you know, whites are on the verge of losing their majority status probably in the next 20 years or so. So we've come to a point where every group in America now feels threatened. You know, it used to be just at least the whites were, they could do invidious things, but they were comfortable. But now it's not just blacks and minorities who feel threatened, but whites feel threatened. studies show that I think 67% of working class whites feel more discriminated against than minorities. It's not just Jews and Muslims who feel threatened. Christians feel threatened. With the Me Too movement, it's not just women, but men feel threatened, and Latinos, and everyone feels threatened. And when people feel threatened, that's when they retreat into tribalism and they get insular. And that's kind of what we're seeing now, and that's why you see such intense identity politics on both sides of the political spectrum.
The book is Political Tribes from Professor Amy Chua of the Yale Law School. You note, Dr. Chua, that in 1960, the top five countries for immigration to the United States were Italy, Germany, Canada, the United Kingdom, and Poland. In 2000, the top five were Mexico, China, the Philippines, India, and Cuba. That kind of explains where we are right now.
Very much so. And, you know, I mean, I think what's beautiful about America is that our Constitution is ethnically neutral. I mean, obviously, we've not lived up to the ideals in our Constitution for most of our history, but the Constitution itself, you know, different from most other countries, is it's not owned by any particular ethnicity. It's not, doesn't belong to the Irish or the Italians. So America is all of ours. And I think at the moment right now, there's almost like a contest for how to define the American identity. And, you know, I think the secret is what I coin a term, America is a supergroup. And this is actually very rare if you look around the world. We're a country where, first of all, we have a very strong national identity, American. But at the same time, we allow individual subgroup identities to flourish. Like, at our best, you know, I'm Libyan-American, Croatian-American, French-Canadian-American, Chinese-American. And you should be able to have all those identities and be, you know, considered, you know, a great patriot at the same time. And that concept is kind of breaking down right now, under strain, again, from extreme elements, I think, on both sides of the political spectrum. I always get in trouble for everything I do because I think with most books, people always want to say, is this a right-wing book or a left-wing book? And then you just pick your political tribe. It's like you just decide if it's on your side, you embrace it. If it's not, you attack it. Well, this book is actually about overcoming political tribalism. So I do not pull my punches on either side. So you should see the kind of the angry tweets I get from both directions. But I think that's just an instantiation of the problem, that we have to get out of this mentality where it's really us versus them on every single issue. And it's preventing us from having incredibly urgently needed conversations, you know, for example, about gun control or immigration and all these big issues that really affect people's lives.
You note that America has two white tribes. What do you mean, Professor?
Something that has happened in the last 20 years or so, because we have so much more inequality and lack of geographical mobility. You know, it used to be somebody in the middle of the country would just, you know, could move to San Francisco or New York and get a job. But now it's so expensive to go to the coasts, and there's so much rigidity that we're losing that fluidity. So the result is that you have a group that, it's a little bit of a misnomer, but I'll use the term coastal elites. And these are kind of people that I know. They're on the coast, like New York or California. They tend to be very multicultural and progressive and cosmopolitan and very well educated. And, you know, in full disclosure, this is the group that I belong to. But the problem is that these whites view a lot of the whites that are blue-collar, living in rural areas or in the middle of the country, as bumpkins, these bigoted, racist. They don't use the right words, which I think has just gone too far on the left. It's almost like a game of gotcha. You know, like, if you don't use the latest politically correct terminology, then you're immediately branded a racist. And that's just, I don't think that's so productive for anybody. But the antipathy and the hatred, or, you know, the resentment runs in both directions. A lot of people from the middle of the country, they think of themselves as, we're the real Americans. And these people on the coasts, they're always favoring minorities and immigrants and the global poor. They're traitors, and they're you know, we want to, they're not, they don't care about the real people. And you could see in the Trump movement that this is exactly the rhetoric that we've seen in countries all over mm-hmm. Latin America and other parts of the world, where it's time to take back our country. Again, us versus them. You know, make America great again. You know, let's get our place back. And so this is very destructive. You have whites are essentially split down the middle, and it's really in some ways an educational divide. And this is also contributing to the tribalism we have in this country.
The book again is Political Tribes from Dr. Amy Chua of the Yale Law School. You have a segment in here, World Wrestling Entertainment and the Trump Phenomenon. And you also note that NASCAR Nation has a certain connotation. We live in the South, where most of our listeners are congregated, obviously. And this is certainly a part of the country that has some of the same feelings that you just talked about, that the middle part of the country has, feeling as though perhaps we have a better mousetrap here, and this certainly was at play in the presidential campaign in 2016, wasn't it?
Yes, very much so. I mean, you know, a lot of people don't get it. They say, why would some blue-collar workers vote for a billionaire? Are they getting conned? And so what I describe in the book is I clarify this. It's actually, it's a cultural tribe. President Donald Trump has even though he's a billionaire, the way he talks and acts, and he's not politically correct, and he goes to the wrestling ring, and he eats McDonald's, it's very much more relatable to a lot of Americans. And so for the kind of elites on the coast, every time he says something, and then everybody jumps on him and says, that's racist, that's sexist, we all think, okay, now he's going to go down. But in fact, for a lot of ordinary Americans, that just makes them more relatable. You know, they're constantly being told at work that they said something that was inappropriate. And so it's like a cultural identification that's very tribal. And I think progressives often don't understand that, you know, because they're doing something very important, standing up for inequality. We've got to fight inequality. But they forget that a lot of just kind of lower income Americans, they want to rise. They want to believe in the American dream. You know, socialism has never had a really strong hold in this country, even among, you know, working class people. So Donald Trump has done an amazing job at presenting himself as a member of the tribe of a lot of people, even though he was born a billionaire in Manhattan. And I think, you know, I don't think there's a mystery once you view things in terms of the lens of cultural tribalism.
We're short on time, but you describe something called white lash, saying it may seem absurd to some, but 2/3 of white working class Americans feel discrimination against whites is as big of a problem today as discrimination against blacks and other minorities. And that's what people think. And when people think that way, quite often they react in a certain way.
Yes, I think that's true. And, you know, it is actually true that, you know, at least in the past, we just did a survey at Yale Law School, and we historically have not had any outreach to poor working class whites in Appalachia. The diversity has been focused in other directions. So we discovered that we actually have only one working class white in the entire 200 person class. And again, even this conversation instantly gets polarized and tribal. You know,
okay, we do have to roll, but thank you, Dr. Chua. It's in a compelling book, Political Tribes, Group Instinct and the Fate of Nations, from Dr. Amy Chua. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.